Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Kentucky and Oregon Democratic primary results last night, a big split screen. Senator Clinton won very white Kentucky by a whopping 35 points. Senator Obama took liberal Oregon by 16. But the primary's end in sight. Race and class divides in the Democratic Party are unmistakable, but are they bridgeable? Last night, Hillary Clinton, who has boasted of her white working class support, said never give up, never give in.
I'm going to keep making our case until we have a nominee, whoever she may be.
Barack Obama, who has soared on a different combination, circled back to Iowa for what sounded like a practice victory lap.
We have returned to Iowa with a majority of delegates elected by the American people, and you have put us within reach of the Democratic nomination for President of the United States of America.
This hour, On Point, race, class, and the Democrats after the Clinton-Obama primary battle. We will check in later in this hour on Democratic Senator Ted Kennedy and the news of his brain tumor. But joining me first today for a look at Kentucky and Oregon is Johanna Newman, reporter for the Los Angeles Times. She's been following the long arc of this primary season and joins us from Washington. Johanna, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. It's my pleasure.
What do we see in the numbers out of Kentucky and Oregon? What do they tell us about demographics and constituencies for these two candidates, Johanna?
Well, I think it's much as you said. It's sort of a tale of two states or two regions, two templates, two very different places. In Oregon, Obama won the vote of whites. He actually won among white voters 55 to 43. In Kentucky, among those same voters, he lost 72 to 23. And you can go down the list for any matrix you want, looking at the exit polls, and you'll see that, you know, even among the demographic that has been so reliable for Hillary Clinton until now, those who did not go to college, in Kentucky, those who had no college education went 75-60 for Clinton. And in Oregon, Obama won those votes 50 to 48. So I think it is a fascinating fall election that we're looking toward, where I know Hillary Clinton and her supporters have made the case that she is the better candidate for those so-called Reagan Democrats, the white Democrats who, you know, through the threat of Appalachia. But I think that Obama's Electoral College map looks much different than hers, and I think he's hoping to pick up Colorado, maybe win one or maybe two states in the South that Democrats haven't been able to do in many a year, maybe North Carolina, maybe Virginia. So they have different prisms through which they look at the nation.
Maybe just a different array. The race question was put to voters as they came out of the polls in Kentucky, and no small number of voters in the Democratic primaries there said straight up, yes, race was a factor in my vote.
It was pretty remarkable, Tom, because in the past, we've assumed that people keep that opinion to themselves, certainly don't share it with a pollster, that they do the politic thing of saying, oh, of course not, race was not an issue in my vote. And pollsters even have an artifice to get around that because they miss some contests by depending on it. So the artifice is to ask people, well, I know you wouldn't consider race an issue, but what about your neighbor?
But something like 20% said
21% in Kentucky said race was important to them, and they went for Clinton overwhelmingly. Again, the flip side in Oregon, nearly 90% said race was not an issue, and they split their votes kind of in, you know, between the two.
Barack Obama in Iowa last night, all but claiming the mantle there, coming very close to it. What's the scenario, Johanna, by which the Clinton camp sees the possibility of her pulling this out, if indeed she can at all?
Well, it comes down to your skills in math, and the Clinton campaign has calculation based on getting all the delegates that they won in Nevada, in Michigan and Florida. You know, those are the two disputed primaries,
right,
where candidates did not run. The party was punishing them for holding their primaries early and so forth. I think she's also running for the future. There's been a recent groundswell in the last few days among outraged women who are furious that she's being written off, and they've taken out full-page ads in the newspapers saying, "Not so fast, Hillary's voice is our voice, and she is speaking for all of us." And I think it's pretty clear that Clinton in the last month has really found her voice. She said she had found it way back in the winter in New Hampshire, but she really came into her own in the last month. And I think the manner of her leaving will be as important to Barack Obama's future as her own. I think if she, and I expect her to be gracious, but if she rallies her troops, this army of now enraged women who see grievance in the process, if she manages to rally them for the fall campaign, I think it will position her to be the next candidate. And if she doesn't, if we start to hear talk of dissension or people sitting on their hands and so forth, it could hurt both of them.
In Puerto Rico's primary, June 1st. Montana and South Dakota wrap it up on June 3rd. Hillary Clinton saying, "Never give up, never give in." Barack Obama in something like a victory lap already. Johanna Newman with the LA Times out of Washington. Thank you very much, Johanna, for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
We are talking this hour about race and class and the Democrats. We're at 800-423-TALK. In a few minutes, we'll hear from political scientist Wilbur Rich and pollster Anna Greenberg. But joining me first from Atlanta, Georgia, for a closer look at the political demographics and divisions we're right in front of us here is Alan Abramowitz, professor of political science at Emory University. He's been looking closely at the white working class vote in particular and how it has shifted over time. His forthcoming book is The Engaged Public. Professor Abramowitz, thanks very much for being with us.
Glad to be with you.
What do you see emerging here against the backdrop of history in this current contest and the Democrats' array as they head into the November election? Can they pull the very different constituencies we're just hearing described there in Kentucky and Oregon together?
That's right. And what we've been seeing over the last several decades, actually, has been a gradual shift in the composition of the Democratic electoral base. Back in the 1950s and 60s, the white working class was really at the core of the Democratic base. That was really the heart of the Democratic vote. That has been changing over time for a couple of reasons. One, the white working class has been shrinking in size relative to the overall electorate. And second, the white working class has been moving away from the Democratic Party for a long time. And so in the last couple of presidential elections, in fact, the Democrats have lost the white vote overall by a pretty big margin, 17 points in 2004. And the white working class vote, if you define that as whites without a college education, by an even bigger margin. So what we're seeing in these primaries is, to some extent, a reflection of this long-term trend. And how that plays out in 2008, I think, will have a great deal to do with the ultimate outcome of the election.
Can Barack Obama win without a much better showing among white voters, white working-class voters, than John Kerry or Al Gore had, Alan Abramowitz?
He has to improve at least a little bit. Let's keep in mind that even though John Kerry lost the white working class vote by 17 points, he only lost the national popular vote by less than 3 points. And that's, of course, because the white working class is only a minority of the electorate. And the overall white percentage of the electorate has been shrinking over time. So the percentage of whites in the electorate has gone down from over 90% in the 1950s and 60s to now it's about three quarters of the electorate, about 75%. And so what that means, of course, is that Democrats don't need to win a majority of the white vote, or even close to a majority of the white vote. They just have to kind of hold down their losses there, and then do well among non-white voters.
Is there evidence that Hillary Clinton could have, would have, will get a significantly bigger portion of that white vote than Gore or Kerry would have, much more in the general than Barack Obama may?
I think the evidence there is pretty mixed. In most of the recent polling data, what we see is that Hillary Clinton does a little bit better than Barack Obama in a general election matchup against John McCain among certain types of white voters, particularly the less educated and older white voters. But Obama does better than Clinton among better educated and younger white voters. And so their strengths kind of offset each other. And so it kind of depends on what poll you look at. I mean, some polling data suggests that overall Clinton does a little bit better among white voters. Other polling data suggests there's little or no difference. And we really won't know, I think, how Obama will, stack up against McCain until after this Democratic nomination race is settled.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about race and class in the Democratic Party on the day after big votes in Kentucky and Oregon, looking at how all this may sort out once the Clinton-Obama primary battle is finished, however, whenever, wherever that happens. There's a lot of history here on this party, a big shift we were just hearing described by Alan Abramowitz, who joins us from Emory University in Atlanta this hour. If we go look way back on the presidential campaign trail in Indianapolis, this is in 1968, Senator Robert F. Kennedy gave a now famous speech on the night of Martin Luther King's assassination, April 4th, 1968. A lot of Democratic Party watchers look back with some nostalgia at Kennedy's crossover appeal to both African Americans and working class and poor whites.
What we need in the United States is not division. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but is love and wisdom and compassion toward one another, and a feeling of justice toward those who still suffer within our country, whether they be white or whether they be black.
Robert F. Kennedy on the night of Martin Luther King's assassination, April 1968. Of course, his brother, Senator Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts, has just been diagnosed with a cancerous brain tumor. And later in the show today, we'll speak with the Boston Globe's Washington Bureau Chief to get the latest on that front. Alan Abramowitz has joined us from Emory University. I want to welcome in a couple more great voices here. With us from Washington, D.C. is Anna Greenberg, Senior Vice President and pollster for Greenberg Quinlan Rosner Research, strategic consulting firm, and pollsters do a lot of political work focusing on Democrats, assisted in the campaigns of Bill Clinton, Al Gore, Walter Mondale, the firm has, and dozens of other prominent politicians. Anna Greenberg, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And with me in the studio, Wilbur Rich, professor of political science at Wellesley College, Hillary Clinton's alma mater. He studies American presidential politics and the politics of minority groups. He's the author of African American Perspectives on the Political Science Discipline. Wilbur Rich, thank you very much for joining
us.
Anna, you're our pollster. You've got the numbers. You know the history. What do you see going on when it comes to race and class in this election cycle in the Democratic Party?
Well, I think it's a little bit unfortunate. There's a question you posed at the beginning of the segment about Hillary Clinton pointing to white working class voters supporting her in the primary. I think what's unfortunate is that there's been a conversation about the primary as if somehow it's applicable to the general. In other words, Hillary Clinton has the possibility of bringing in those voters and Barack Obama doesn't because of her success in the primary. I think, and this is something that Alan mentioned, if you look at the polls on the general election, both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama are doing about the same with white working class voters. Barack Obama does sort of slightly better among men. She does slightly better among women, some of the other divisions that Alan talked about. And in fact, they are doing about the same as both John Kerry and Al Gore did. Now, I'm not suggesting acceptable that the Democratic Party struggles with white working class voters, but to suggest that this is somehow different than what we've seen in the last, you know, two presidential elections, I think is a mistake.
But that was the gist of what Hillary Clinton herself was saying there, right? That she was proving out in the primaries, quoting her here, support among working, hardworking Americans, white Americans, saying Obama's was weakening again. The implication being that that would be a problem for Democrats if he's the candidate in November.
Well, she has to make the case about why she's electable in the general election as part of the entire case about why she should, you know, get the nomination. And I understand her making that argument. I actually think that the real issue is there are probably a segment of white Democrats who will not vote for Barack Obama because of race. And I'm not sure that there's anything that, you know, Barack Obama can do about that. On the other hand, I think you're going to see the overall composition of the electorate change if Barack Obama is the nominee. So I think you will see a pretty substantial increase in youth turnout, which has increased in 2004 and 2006 and has tripled in the primaries. If you look at the polling, you know, Hillary Clinton's much weaker among younger voters. I think you'll, even though turnout's relatively high among African Americans, I think you'll see even more intensity in turnout there if he's the nominee. So it's my view that probably for the segment of sort of white Democrats who will not vote for Barack Obama, it is offset by some real changes in the electorate, new voters that he brings in.
Wilbur Rich with me in the studio. How do you see that? Enormous turnouts among minority voters in North Carolina and elsewhere for Barack Obama and young voters, as Anna Greenberg says. On the other hand, Hillary Clinton points to West Virginia and now Kentucky and her very large margins of victory there and what we've seen in the exit polls and said, be careful, I'm bringing in an important sector here that Barack Obama may not. Do you see him as viable without that Clinton sector, if it's hers? Can she hand it to him if she chooses to?
I think it's going to be very difficult for the Democratic Party to win without the white vote. I mean, the white working class vote. I think that what they're suggesting that they can redesign the New Deal coalition, reorient the New Deal coalition away from the white working class. I don't think that's possible. I think that it's very important that Obama makes a big reach out, so to speak, to the working class voters of all races. You can't forget the black working class either.
Mm-hmm.
And so you got to have a good strategy to get them out to the polls. So I don't think that the people who are running his campaign are writing off the white working class.
Alan Abramowitz, give us a little history lesson, if you'd be good enough, on the sort of arc of how these race and class lines in the Democratic Party has shifted over the decades.
Well, what we've seen over the last 40 to 50 years is that the contribution of African-American and Hispanic voters to the Democratic Party has been increasing. And at the same time, the white working class contribution to the Democratic Electoral Coalition has been decreasing. And so, you know, this is a long-term shift that's been going on for many, many years. And the interesting thing to me is what we're seeing, if you look at the results of these primaries, is that though the white working class is not, you know, identical across the whole country,
mm-hmm.
that there's a big difference between the behavior of the white working class in Kentucky and Oregon. You know, there are lots of white working class voters in Oregon, and they were much more likely to vote for Barack Obama than similar voters in Kentucky and West Virginia. So I think we have to be careful not to lump all of these people together. And, you know, even when you kind of look within some of these demographic categories, whether it be white working class or women or older voters, that what you see is that there's a lot of variation across states. Barack Obama got 57% of the white vote in Oregon, and he got about, you know, 50% of the white female vote in Oregon, and he did very well even among less educated white voters in Oregon. He did very poorly among those voters in Kentucky. So there's something else, you know, going on here, and I think we can't lose sight of the these regional differences. I think Kentucky and West Virginia would be very, very difficult states for Barack Obama to win. I don't think Hillary Clinton would necessarily win those states either. But the good news for Obama is that he doesn't need to win those states.
Anna Greenberg, George Bush, W. Bush, won white working class voters by 23 points in 2004, his reelection campaign. Alan Abramowitz points out in a paper he did recently, that's a huge margin. Do you see, on the other hand, now we're in the midst of a fairly challenging economic time for people of all races. Do you see the economics of 2008, quite apart from the candidates, maybe changing the complexion of the Democrats' potential white working class vote?
I do. And let me follow up on something that Wilbur said, which is I completely agree that nobody in the Democratic Party, and certainly not Barack Obama, should be sort of ceding the white working class vote. And I don't think anyone would say that they were. I do believe one way of thinking about reaching out is on economic issues. One of the things that has not happened yet because of the dynamics of what happened in the Democratic primary is we haven't had a real conversation about John McCain. And where John McCain is on a huge range of economic issues is profoundly out of touch with the economic anxieties of you know, working class voters in this country. I think when we have that conversation, there is going to be a segment of the white, you know, working class vote that is going to support Barack Obama. We haven't had that conversation yet, and I think that Alan was right when he said we're not going to really know how it plays out until we get into a real general election conversation.
I also want to add, by the way,
that Alan's exactly right about the geography here. One of the things that I find a little bit sort of annoying in this whole, the whole conversation about the white working class vote is the suggestion that West Virginia or Kentucky are states that any Democrat is going to win. West Virginia has been trending Republican for a few election cycles now and is just farther and farther out of reach. It's not really on the list of battleground states, and certainly Kentucky, Tennessee, states like that are not in the battleground for most analysts. So, you know, even if Hillary Clinton does do better in those states among white working class voters, in general, they're not states that Democrats are going
to
win.
I want to begin to turn to our listeners. Let's go to South Carolina, Aiken, South Carolina, and John. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Yes. I just would like to make a comment on actually what I perceive to be the biggest contributor to the divide. If you look at how the election results play out, like in the beginning of the primary process, you can see up until South Carolina, Barack Obama only had about 70 to 80% of the African American vote. But if you see after Hillary Clinton's strategy change to find a way to take away from some of this momentum to try to separate, get some of her voters to make up the difference, you see that there is a great shift in the percentage of voters. And then you have the Jeremiah Wright situation that came out, and you can see the bigger divide.
So how do you interpret that? What's going on there, John?
Well, what I see is that, you know, there's a great dilemma in the Democratic Party now. We have two great candidates. They're both almost neck and neck in their voting record, neck and neck in their policies, and there's little difference between them. And so people have to find other reasons, other things that make them different from the other candidate. And unfortunately, they're going to race and other cultural things that actually divide us. But I believe that in the general election, that once we have only two candidates, either a Republican or a Democrat, that all these issues will go away, because the biggest issue is the war and the economy.
John, let us pick it up, and let me put that to Wilbur Rich. It's a good point. Professor Rich, how about it? Do you see this campaign having been racialized, either by the individual campaigns, by, I don't know, the media, or is this a natural trend line that we're on in terms of the polls and exit polls we're reading?
I think that race is always going to be a problem in American politics. I think that the idea that the image of the Republican Party as the party of whites will help Mr. McCain. But I think that the campaign will obviously turn on some very critical economic issues and the war. But I don't downplay the ability of Mr. McCain to rally people around some of his issues. So I think race is still going to be there. There are going to be people who are not going to vote for Mr. Obama because he is black. But I think that he will also get some votes because he is black. So it evens itself out.
Anna Greenberg says we should put West Virginia and Kentucky perhaps in a special class or category. Kentuckians in exit polls saying 21% saying race was a factor in their vote. Do you see that kind of significant race consideration in other important states?
Well, I think in the South, but that's the difference between the New South and the Old South. But I think it's interesting that Senator Robert Byrd mm-hmm. of Virginia, West Virginia, mm-hmm. Endorsed Obama, which is shocking to me. I mean, I think Obama should make some ads with him. I mean,
huge Clinton win there.
Exactly. I think these states can be competitive. But I think that he probably will have a difficult time, more difficult time, I suspect, in Kentucky than he will West Virginia. So I think that the people who are running his campaign know that these states, which states are competitive, which states are not competitive, and that's why they're going to allocate their resources. Mm.
Let's take a call from Diane in Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Diane. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I was calling because I'm a little frustrated with all of this race, class, conclusion. I don't know that it's always valid. My husband and I both have graduate degrees. We therefore don't fall into the lower class definition by either education or income.
Mm-hmm.
We're both white. We're both Hillary Clinton supporters. I can't speak for him, but for myself, I don't want to vote for Senator Obama, not because of his race, but because he has yet to convince me that he has the experience or the policies that I'm looking for. What I hear is a lot of golden-tongued rhetoric, and what I don't hear is substance. What I don't hear is concrete proposals. And although I'm very much opposed to the war in Iraq and therefore will have a hard time voting for Senator McCain, still in all, if that were the choice, I would vote for Senator McCain.
And you're saying you're looking at it on the merits. Let's leave race and class out of it in your consideration. Alan Abramowitz, what about it? Nationwide, can that point fairly be made? I'm looking here at the paper you did with Rui Teixeira, the decline of the white working class and the rise of a mass upper middle class. You're pretty focused on class and, for that matter, race right there. Can they be discounted, or do they play in whether we like it or not?
Well, I agree with something that was said earlier, that I think that Barack Obama or any Democratic candidate has some real opportunities this year, I think, to increase the Democratic Party's support among white working class voters and other types of voters. And that's because the national political climate is extremely difficult for Republicans this year. We have an extremely unpopular Republican president in the White House. We have an unpopular war, and we have an economy that is very weak. And so, you know, you've got to, as well as the fact that the Republicans have been in the White House for 8 years. So those are three factors, the president's unpopularity, the state of the economy, and the fact that it's been 8 years of Republicans in the White House that point very strongly in the Democratic direction. White working class voters are, at least white working class Democrats, are strongly opposed to the war and disapprove of Bush. So I think that's where Obama has a real opportunity to do better than, say, John Kerry did among these white working class voters. The national political climate is much more favorable for Democrats this year than it was in 2004.
Anna, when you do the matchups, Obama versus McCain or Clinton versus McCain, what are you seeing in your polling?
Well, I mean, what you see are, you know, is relatively similar. The dynamics of our, when you get to a general election context, is that most people vote their party. So most people who call themselves Democrats or even lean Democrat vote Democratic, and most people who lean Republican vote Republican. And then there's independents in the middle. There's some differences that, you know, matter. For instance, Barack Obama is doing, you know, better than Hillary Clinton among independent voters, which is obviously a key swing group. Hillary Clinton's doing better with older voters. So there's some minor differences, but overall, the basic coalitions that have been in place in the last two cycles are here as well.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about race and class in the Democratic Party after the Clinton-Obama battle, wherever, however, that battle ends. Anna Greenberg joins us from Washington, D.C., Senior Vice President, pollster for Greenberg Quinlan Rosner Research Associates, strategic consulting firm there. Wilbur Rich is with me in the studio, Professor of Political Science at Wellesley College. And Alan Abramowitz joins us from Emory University. He joins us from Atlanta there, author of the forthcoming book, The Engaged Public. Alan Abramowitz, you've done some really interesting work on this. Look ahead for us, if you would. You write and talk about the white working class actually continuing to shrink, and you write about the rise of a mass upper middle class. How do those two dance looking forward here? How do they figure into 08 politics and politics on down the road for Democrats first?
Well, there's no question when you look at the occupational structure of the electorate or the educational structure of the electorate that there's been a long-term shift, and that change is going to continue. The proportion of voters who are, for example, in manual occupations versus white-collar occupations has been declining for many years. The proportion of voters without any college education has been declining for many years, while the proportion of college graduates has been increasing. So there's every reason to expect those trends to continue. And so that's affecting the composition of the Democratic and Republican electoral coalitions, but particularly the Democratic electoral coalition, because the Democrats traditionally depended very heavily on the white working class during the New Deal and post-New Deal era. But if we look at the Democratic Party today, the white working class is still an important component in that you can't win without at least a modicum of support among white working class voters. But it means that if you look at Democratic voters today, the proportion of college graduates, the proportion of professionals and people with professional and managerial occupations, for example, is actually much larger than the proportion of manual workers in the Democratic Party. So demography just sort of dictates to a considerable extent the way things are going to go. But that doesn't mean that the economic issues are not going to be important, because the economy affects everyone.
Wilbur Rich, do you see this changing economy, the changing white working class, for that matter? I mean, globalization is changing all working class. But does this eventually drive white and black, lower income working class voters together? Or do we see, white working Americans moving up into what Alan calls the mass upper middle class, away again from, let's say, black voters? Do we get yet another divide, a new generation of divide?
Well, I don't know. I'm not as optimistic about this mass upper middle class white majority that he's talking about. I also would say he's not talking anything about the white underclass, which is the unemployed people that's increasing in the United States. But I think that, I think that any Democratic Party that tries to structure itself without the white vote, without the white working class vote, is engaged in a death wish. I mean, you literally have to have a diversity in the party, and you don't want the Republican Party to be the tribune for the white working class. It's just, you can't do that. And I don't think that Mr. Obama is going to do that. I think he's smarter than that.
Let's go to Carl in Nashville. Hi, Carl. You're on the air.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
All right. What do you see, Carl?
Well, I tell you, if we're going to have this discussion, let's be brutally honest with each other, and let's stop dancing around the answer and the question. White working class people started leaving the Democratic Party in the 50s and 60s when civil rights come about for black people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when they left the Democratic Party because of that, these people still today in places like Kentucky and West Virginia still hold resentment toward the Democrat Party for pushing that. And if you don't believe me, look at the exit polling in Kentucky and West Virginia, how many people openly said that they would not vote for a black candidate, and match those white working class people up against white working class people in states like Wisconsin, which he won, and Oregon. So there is a resentment toward the Democrat Party from the 50s and the 60s, and I believe that those people, until they change their mindset, no Democrat will win those states anyway on a consistent basis.
Carl, let me ask you, do you think Barack Obama can pull enough white working class voters over that bump of resentment, which no doubt...
I believe he can in other states. In some states like West Virginia and Kentucky, I don't believe he could win those votes, because let's face it, those people are not going to vote for a black candidate. They're not going to vote for a black candidate no matter how many times he goes there. But there's other white working class people in different states, like I said, in Wisconsin, and which, you know, basically, let's face it, the only thing black in Wisconsin are players on the Green Bay Packers team. Let's
well, maybe. I mean, go to Milwaukee. It's
go
a little
Milwaukee.
Different. But, yeah, but point taken, Carl, and thanks for that. Let's get one more from Londonderry, Vermont. Jason, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
First, I wanted to I wanted to address the graduate student who decided she would vote for McCain and say that for a long time I've been really frustrated because the media seems to cover the horse race and not the issues really in depth. And I was so impressed with the way Obama has been able to be steadfast in his character and in the way he dealt with the whole right thing. And I think that what I feel now, since North Carolina, that when it comes to him being elected, that he will be able to change things in a way that I think a player like McCain or Clinton couldn't. But I wanted to say that I wonder if the whites working class has been leaving the Democratic Party, not because of civil rights, but more since the Reagan era, since this new Republican Party started their media campaign for being for gods and guns and country, and I have sold their message so well, and they've turned liberal and Democrat into a bad word, where you're feeding the bureaucratic machine and
right.
using welfare money to
right. Jason, our time grows short. Let us look at exactly that question. Alan Abramowitz, is there any question that the turn began with the civil rights movement, or did it take a kind of message machine to create the exodus of some whites from the Democratic Party, considerable number of white working class?
Well, the movement away from the Democrats has been concentrated among white voters in general, and white working class voters in particular, has been concentrated among conservative white voters. And it isn't just racial issues. That's part of it. But these are voters who are also have been moving toward the Republicans because of their views on social issues and national security issues as well. So the Republicans have had an appeal to white working class voters that goes beyond just the race issue. That definitely is part of it, especially in states like West Virginia and Kentucky, but that's certainly not the entire story.
Anna Greenberg, you mentioned earlier a new map that may be emerging here, a new map that the Obama campaign may be looking at with an eye toward victory. What does that look like, and does it change the sort of traditional race class lines that we've imagined running through American presidential politics?
Well, I think that we don't know for sure, but it looks like a Barack Obama as nominee can potentially open up the West for Democrats in ways that we've been unsuccessful in the past. So Colorado, New Mexico is a very important state that went for, by a very close margin for Bush in 2004. Obviously Arizona is out of reach for understandable reasons, but even the Plains states where Obama's done well. So I don't think we'll win in, Nebraska, but it's possible that Democrats start doing a little better in those states. And, there's some very important House races in some of those states where, the top of the ticket doing better can help at the House and Senate level. So I think that there's some evidence that Barack Obama opens up the map in the West. I think, and I am, I'm going to go back to the fact that, Kentucky and West Virginia have not been in play for Democrats for a long time for all the reasons that everybody talked about. What's more concerning is some of the struggles that Obama may have in the Midwest, especially Ohio, potentially, Iowa. Kerry barely won Wisconsin. So I think that is, in some ways, the more troubling area for him. One thing I want to add, we haven't talked about the Hispanic vote. And it's, this isn't an area, this is, while Hispanic voters are still a smaller part of the electorate than African Americans, they are the fastest growing portion of the electorate. And they are a critical group in this whole discussion of race and class and ethnicity. And Hillary Clinton did quite well among Hispanics in the primaries, but Obama Obama is poised to certainly do better than John Kerry. So I think that, you know, we have to look at the overall, the diversity in this electorate, and there's some dynamics with the Hispanic vote that I think can be very favorable to Barack Obama.
Some constants here, but also you have to keep your eye on change in the American political map, and we appreciate each of you for helping us do that this hour. Anna Greenberg joining us from Washington. Anna, it's good to hear from you. Thank you very much
for being
with us.
Thanks for having me.
With me in the studio, Wilbur Rich of Wellesley College. Professor Rich, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And from Emory University, joining us from Atlanta, Alan Abramowitz, author of the forthcoming The Engaged Public. Professor Abramowitz, thank you for being with us.
Glad to be with you.
In a moment, Senator Ted Kennedy's latest fight with cancer. News yesterday that Senator Edward Kennedy, Democrat of Massachusetts, has been diagnosed with a malignant brain tumor. The brother of John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy has been in the Senate 46 years, a long time as torchbearer for a party and an American political dynasty. Words of support right across party lines for Kennedy yesterday. Here's an emotional Democratic Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia.
Ted, my dear friend, I love you, and I miss you.
Peter Kanellis is Washington Bureau Chief and columnist for the Boston Globe and joins us now from Washington, D.C. Peter, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
An extraordinary degree of emotion from Senator Robert Byrd there yesterday, but really an outpouring almost surprising in its depth, given the rough history there's been here for Ted Kennedy on along partisan lines, right across Republican-Democratic divide.
Well, it's not especially surprising to people who've been following his Senate career in recent years, because while he has a reputation in national politics as the ultimate Democratic partisan, in the Senate he is one of the leading peacemakers, you know, known for always extending courtesies to his Republican colleagues, working very, very hard to get Republican co-sponsors for bills, and, you know, being willing sometimes to take half a loaf if it's a way of building a bridge to his Republican colleagues.
Senator Kennedy, now out of the hospital in Boston, what are you hearing, Peter, about expectations there, about when or whether he will be back, you know, in his office, on the floor of the Senate, back at work?
I think that, you know, generally there are expectations in sort of an optimistic way of people saying they're looking forward to him coming back and he's going to be back at work, but we've not heard anything specific yet from Kennedy's staff. I'm sure that that will be, you know, determined in concert with his treatment program, which doctors, I gather, are still developing. So.
And, you know, can you give us a sense of what he's been in the midst of just in recent days? This kind of came out of the blue, did come out of the blue. What has Ted Kennedy been up to? He's one of the most prolific legislators in the Senate in history. What's he been up to in the last few weeks and months?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the last few weeks and months, I mean, children's health has been a huge issue for him. He's been also doing a whole lot of campaigning for Barack Obama, I think, as everybody knows. He's always maintained a tremendous pace of constituent services. I think we all saw that, you know, on Friday he was in New Bedford for a ribbon cutting at a local opening of a local social service center. You know, I saw him last Wednesday speaking before a group of people from Lowell and Lawrence. You know, he maintains this very, very active schedule on so many different fronts, constituent services, building up legislation. Obviously, immigration's been another big priority for him. I mean, he's warming up for another, you know, healthcare run as soon as there's a new president in. So it's been a very busy time.
And how has it unfolded, Peter, that Ted Kennedy, I mean, he's been such a kind of whipping boy for conservative talk radio, let's say, at that level of the Republican face. He's just taken blow, you know, hit after hit, a favorite target of all kinds of derision. But at the same time, among his colleagues, a greater respect. Where's the line between those two worlds? And how did he manage within the Senate to get across that line?
Well, I think one thing that happened was he gave up after 1980 his ambitions to be president. You know, his name was mentioned in 84 and 88, but I think it became clear, at least in a gradual way to him, that he was not going to be president and that he could actually accrue a lot of power in the Senate by not having to sort of trim his sails in the way that presidential candidates do, and also not having to make some of the gratuitous partisan gestures that presidential candidates have to do. So, you know, he was free to sort of stand up for unpopular causes, but he was also free to compromise with colleagues in a way that, you know, many Democrats who want to be president can't do. And so suddenly there emerged this kind of new role of Kennedy as this great institutional force in the Senate.
What has it meant for Barack Obama to have had Edward Kennedy stand up for him in this primary season, Peter? And what if his campaign schedule is reduced by the health fight that he's in the midst of now?
Well, to answer your second question first, I mean, I think that Kennedy's great value to Obama was in the Democratic primaries, which are now ending. I don't think Ted Kennedy will be of much help to Obama in the general election campaign. You know, obviously in the general election campaign, people like to emphasize their sort of centrist credentials, and Kennedy still, you know, his constituency are true blue Democrats. But in that primary campaign, you know, having the credibility of, you know, the senior Democrat Party patriarch endorsing you means a lot for a candidate who is viewed by many people as too inexperienced to be president.
Peter Kanellis, Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. Peter, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Our thoughts go out to Ted Kennedy and his family. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Ping Wong, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby, with help from Jamie Katsoufis. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.